Support for Left, Right, and Center comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/LRC. That's odoo.com/LRC. Odoo, modern management made simple.
This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and the Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It is the last week of October, and this week Ambassador Bill Taylor described a quid pro quo. He says National Security Council official Tim Morrison told him around the start of September that the release of military aid to Ukraine would be conditioned on a Ukrainian announcement of an investigation into Burisma, the energy company whose board Hunter Biden sat on. And EU Ambassador Gordon Sondland confirmed that to Taylor, saying he'd made a mistake when he'd said earlier that only a White House meeting depended on such an announcement. In fact, everything depended on it. Sondland explained to Taylor that the president is a businessman and that, quote, when a businessman is about to sign a check to someone who owes him something, the businessman asks that person to pay up before signing the check, unquote. Now let's bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel. As always, I'm your center. I'm joined by Rich Lowry, editor of National Review on the right. And on the left, Lynette Lopez, columnist at Business Insider. Hello.
Hey, Josh.
Hey, Josh.
So, Rich, you've complained previously on this show about the pattern of presidents usurping the constitutional powers of Congress over spending. So here, the president did that at least for a time, and all of these people around him came under this understanding that these funds duly appropriated by Congress would not be released unless the president got this thing that he wanted. So not only did he usurp the appropriation power of Congress, he did it for a corrupt purpose in order to extort something of personal use out of the Ukrainians. So why, again, is that not an impeachable offense?
So this testimony is bad. I think we need to see all the transcripts, and we're going to have to hear from all these people in public at a witness table. I think the best defense that Republicans can make of this, and it would have been best for the White House to make this from the beginning, shouldn't have happened. It was improper. We were yanking around an ally for a period of months, and they got the money. The money was duly appropriated, and it was given to Ukraine, and Ukraine made no commitment whatsoever. And my theory at times that this was just an incompetent effort does have some more support in the Taylor testimony, because the Ukrainians are kind of running around saying, what's going on? And you have to talk to this guy. I don't know. I'm not going to tell you. And Taylor repeatedly describes being made uncomfortable with the fact that he can't really tell the Ukrainians what's going on, and they don't know what's going on. So not great testimony. It's another sign that the no quid quo argument is giving way, and it was a mistake for the White House to make that the bright line. And a conventional defense here where you get a fact finder, find everything internally, release it immediately, and say let's move on would have been a better approach than drawing a line in the sand that it looks like it can't be sustained.
I think there's a couple of issues with the line that essentially this was incompetent and it never really came to fruition and they didn't ultimately withhold the money, and so no harm, no foul. And this relates to the issue of, you know, if they were trying to extort the Ukrainians, why didn't they tell them more explicitly we're withholding the aid and you have to do this in order to get us to release the aid? And I think the answer comes in how it didn't come to fruition, which is that once Republicans in Congress figured out what was going on with the withholding of the aid, they lost it and they forced the White House's hand and they forced the release of the aid. And so I think the president actually understood that this had to be done sort of quietly through back channels without anybody noticing if the extortion was to work. And it almost did work. You had that back and forth among Sondland and Volcker about how the Ukrainian president was going to go and give that interview on CNN to announce that he was doing the investigation into Burisma. So I think there's this sort of question of, you know, it's weird, like if he was trying to extort the Ukrainians, why didn't he tell them? But I think we actually have a coherent answer to that question that makes the president look nefarious rather than incompetent.
I think that this is exactly what Michael Cohen was telling us in his testimony. The president doesn't ask for things like this directly. He asks for them in code. And it makes sense that the Ukrainians were confused because he talks like a mafia capo, not a businessman, not a president, but a mafia capo. And so he's not going to say directly, nice little army there that has already seen 13,000 soldiers lost to the Russians. Shame if something else happened to it. He's going to say, mafia stuff. I don't know because I've never been a gangster. But Michael Cohen laid it out pretty clearly in his testimony that the president doesn't talk directly to people that he's trying to shake down. He speaks to them in code.
But so I don't understand why the defense you lay out, Rich, is a defense.
Well, I mean, there's still a dispute. There's a dispute not just between the president and Congress over this. There's a dispute over within the administration what the policy was. And Sondland, who's supposedly the heavy who's carrying this out, Taylor at one point says to Sondland, well, can't you talk the president out of this? This isn't a good idea. And he's like, oh, I'm going to go back to the president and do that. John Bolton opposed this. He meets with the Ukrainians. He doesn't mention it. Mike Pence meets with the Ukrainians. He doesn't mention it. Taylor calls Pompeo. Are we really doing this? No, we're not.
It just sounds like Yakety Sax should be playing in the background, like the beginning of the Benny Hill
show.
Well,
again, it's a lot like the supposed order to Don McGahn to fire Robert Mueller, which shouldn't have made this supposed order.
So
didn't follow up with it and
matter?
Didn't happen.
Intent doesn't matter? If you intend to shake down one of our allies, that doesn't matter?
We've talked about this before. Intent matters in terms of the gravity of the offense. So if there's a murder conspiracy, that's
people
very,
die.
Very bad. But
people
look, this lethal aid was withheld for years on principle by the prior administration, and no one was up in arms about it.
Because it was on principle.
No, but—
That was a policy
dispute. No, but Lynette's argument is this is terrible. People are dying in Ukraine. This is an awful thing that's happening.
There are people dying in Ukraine.
But they got the money.
As the United States of America,
did they get the money?
I decided to give them the money. This is a violation of us, of our principles,
they got the money.
Of who we
they
are.
They got the money.
But he was going to try to hold that up for himself.
But I think this is the wrong standard. I think gravity is the wrong standard. I think that, again, we're talking about an impeachment. We're not talking about a criminal trial. So I think murder is actually not the good analogy. It's about the abuse of the president's power because he was withholding the
funds,
both in violation of the law, even though ultimately he stopped breaking the law. He was doing that for a time.
He didn't break the law. They got the money.
How long are they allowed to impound the money under the Impoundment Act?
If they had held it past September 30th and the money just disappeared, but look, and gravity matters.
If it was a political,
are you saying,
it was, if,
you
if
saying
it was
every...
a transparent political dispute that was holding up the money, then we could have a discussion about that. But it was not a transparent political dispute. It was a subversion of the rule of law, placing the president's own individual desires and his goals ahead of the goals of the American people and the republic. Russia is not our friend. The fact they're attacking Ukraine is a problem for us. It's a problem for the American people. And so we, as a country, have decided we're going to do something about it. The president of the United States does not have the power to unilaterally decide that we've decided to attack Joe Biden's son rather than Vladimir Putin's cronies.
Gravity matters. I mean, do you think every single abuse of power by a president shouldn't be impeached and removed over it?
Well, I think there's two separate questions. There's a question of what Congress can impeach over, and then there's a separate question of what they should impeach over. I think that there is room for discretion by Congress. They can say this falls within the constitutional bounds of what we can impeach over. We're choosing not to do so. But I think this is I think this is grave enough to be impeached over, not because of the actual practical effects of whether or not the aid got to Ukraine, because the question is, you know, the law said the aid was supposed to go to Ukraine. It's not a question of policy analysis, in my view. It's a question of compliance with the law, and it's a question of the purpose for which he was subverting the law. And it was a personal purpose. It would be different, in my view, if it was a matter of a policy dispute, that the president just basically thought, well, you know, this aid to Ukraine is a bad idea for, you know, geopolitical principled reasons, even if he was wrong about that. But here he's doing it because he's using an asset of the U.S. government, which is its foreign policy, and he's using it toward a personal purpose for himself. I think is the grave subversion of the office.
Right. So I'm not arguing it's proper. It's clearly improper, and he shouldn't have done it, and it's blameworthy. Where I think the question of the gravity comes in, are you really going to throw him out of office 12 months before an election where then people get the ability to decide how seriously they take this or not and what action they want to take over it?
So you don't think that we should punish people for violating American principles?
Losing
just
an election
we're
is
an election?
Punishment. Losing an election is punishment.
So, it's not punishment. It's losing an election.
Yes, it is. Yes, it's
we're,
felt
not punishing,
every person.
We're not punishing someone when we lose an election.
You're not throwing him in jail either. You're throwing him out of office, which is the same effect as an election.
I'm confused about the 12 months thing. Like, when is the appropriate time window in which because right after an election, presumably one would say, well, the public just chose this person. Mm-hmm. You can't overturn it right away. You have to give him a chance. So is it only in the second and third years of it? I mean, we're in the third year of the term.
It's really like breaking up with someone. There's really never a good time.
Well,
you're
short-circuiting a democratic process that's about to take place, which means it has to be very grave. It can't be something you thought about doing and argued back and forth and didn't happen. That's my argument. again, there has to be some sliding scale for impeachment, or you would favor, should have favored impeaching President Obama over DACA or his unilateral immigration orders, which are clear abuse of his authority. No, well, there you go. So
no,
I don't think
DACA is the same as.
So a president can write legislation on his
for
own
for the intent.
I mean, I don't want to get too far down on DACA. I mean, I would note. I mean, Obama did say that he lacked the constitutional authority to do that before he turned around and did it. But I think this is a key distinction about, you know, the personal purpose rather than the policy purpose.
Why? You just set out a standard.
Barack Obama didn't pass DACA because he wanted his political enemies to fail, and he wanted to win the next election personally.
He did it for his political coalition, not for himself.
Yeah.
So he can abuse his power as long as the intentions are good. That's
no.
the standard. The constitutional scheme does not matter as long as the person violating it has good intentions.
No.
I just want to hold you guys to your own, see what your standard is. If you don't say gravity makes a difference, the gravity of the offense, and any subversion of the constitutional scheme is impeachable, at the sake of your own consistency, you should have favored impeaching Barack
Obama.
When
the president puts his individual personal desires above the rule of law, that is an impeachable offense.
But
Barack Obama was not putting his individual personal aims above the rule of law for that.
Was,
it was a policy decision for his coalition.
Right.
His back channel personal lawyer wasn't getting paid $500,000 to get it done either.
Okay, I think we need to move on from this area. I do want to talk about some of the action we saw on Capitol Hill this week with regard to this. We saw House Republicans storming into a SCIF, this secure hearing room in which, you know, you're not allowed to bring your electronic devices because you're supposed to make sure that no foreign intelligence agencies are able to listen in. And apparently that rule doesn't apply when you're Matt Gaetz. But it was basically a political effort to complain that, you know, Democrats are doing too much of this behind closed doors. Similarly, you have Lindsey Graham in the Senate moving a resolution complaining that, you know, why isn't this process more open? Why doesn't the minority have subpoena power, as has been the case in some of these prior impeachment inquiries? And so, Rich, what really strikes me about this is it's all a process argument. We're not really seeing a substantive defense of the president's actions. We're just seeing a complaint about the process, and also one that I think is time limited. You know, Republicans go around saying we want public hearings. I think they're going to get those public hearings not that long from now, and I'm not sure they're going to enjoy them.
Yeah, so first of all, I mean, storming the SCIF is obviously bad and juvenile, and they shouldn't have done it. And the process, a more open process, you're right, might not even help them, and they'll get it eventually. But not having the initial vote of the entire House to open the inquiry is a violation of what the usual precedent is, and is a way to kind of establish political accountability for this process. And for whatever reason, Nancy Pelosi didn't do that. And having the interviews in secret for now and just leaking the things that are helpful to you is not the way it should work. And the Taylor opening statement, as I said, I think is quite troubling. But any lawyer or prosecutor tell you, your opening statement is usually when you get the best of it, when none of your claims are subjected to any sort of scrutiny or pushback. And we don't know what that was like, which is really important to know because we haven't seen the rest of the transcript. So I think it all should be released as soon as possible, and we should have public hearings. And this is one reason that I think the process is getting backed up, is they realize they're going to have to go through this, and it will stretch out, you know, at least into December, maybe into the new year.
I like that AOC called them a little flash mob. I thought that was cute. I also thought it was cute that they asked the police to arrest them, and the police were like, no. You wrote in your column this week that you hope that this is done quickly. I think Nancy is going to give it to you guys nice and slow. I don't think so. I think it's going to be like a 90s R&B song. I think it's going to be, you know, dragged out. You're going to watch the polling. The GOP is going to watch the polling. And I hope for your sake and for your sanity.
Thank you, Lynette. You're concerned. You're
for
your oozing sincerity and concern.
I'm always
and
sincere on this show.
And distorting my column.
Rich, why don't you explain what the column said?
Ridiculously. What I said in my column is what we discussed last week. I think the equities of this have shifted politically, where initially it seemed that it made sense for the Democrats to kind of do it quickly, move on. But the polling initially has been quite favorable to impeachment inquiry. Some polls had above 50%. So what's the downside? What's the rush? And I think with Trump, this has not been a good story. Obviously, the facts haven't been great. They've been getting worse rather than better. His reaction hasn't been good. And the only way to kind of close this chapter for him is to get impeached and to get acquitted in the Senate. So I think now his self-interest is seeing this happen as soon as possible, and Nancy Pelosi's self-interest may be stretching it out.
I don't see why she would rush this process. And I think you're right. You know, watching these testimonies in public is not going to be favorable for the Republicans. I don't think anybody even minded that the flash mob, you know, delayed the behind closed doors testimony for 5 hours. As long as the Republicans want to make displays and lengthen this process, I think that Nancy Pelosi is going to be just sipping tea in her office.
I mean, the other funny thing about dragging out this process is that we keep learning about new characters. And so it feels like it's going to be difficult for Democrats to move forward to an impeachment vote, because it feels like even if they're not trying, we're going to keep learning new things. Rich, I was wondering what you made of this new character we got this week, Dmytro Firtash.
Oh, man, yeah.
Who is this Ukrainian oligarch who is an associate of the two guys who got arrested, Igor Fruman and Lev Parnas, who's been in Vienna fighting extradition to the United States since 2013. And there was a long article about this in the Washington Post, but the part of it that stuck out at me was at the end, where it described Parnas and Fruman at some energy industry conference last year bragging to some other businessman about how they're trying to get the ambassador fired in Ukraine because the ambassador is unfavorable to this deal that they want to deal, that they want to do with this oligarch. And he shares a lawyer with it that's within the president's orbit. He's in Vienna, where for whatever reason Fruman and Parnas and Giuliani were all trying to go right when Parnas and Fruman got arrested. It feels to me like you talk about the key area of risk to the president here being Rudy. It feels to me like we keep seeing signs that we're going to learn more about exactly how Rudy was monetizing his access to the president. And I sort of wonder how much it even matters how much the president knew about exactly what Giuliani was doing, because he was allowing sort of a freelance representative for global criminals into the Oval Office to advise him on policy and then using him as his emissary, which seems bad.
Yeah, well, we know at the moment it's colossally poor judgment to have Rudy on this assignment. So I think there are two branches here that we need to learn more about. You know, what was the policy? How was the pressure campaign on the Ukrainians carried out through these official and unofficial policy channels? And then what was Rudy doing? And the darkest, I think, potential there is that Rudy was being paid people. I'm not saying this is by people. I'm not saying this has happened, but I think it's potential. Paid by people in Ukraine to whisper in the president's ears things that these players wanted to be carried out in U.S. policy. And that would be completely explosive revelation.
But this is the second oligarch that we've seen close to the Trump campaign. The first one was Oleg Deripaska and his relationship with Paul Manafort. And this is the third Rudy Giuliani we've seen close to the Trump campaign. Remember that Michael Flynn was pushing for the same things for the Turks that Rudy Giuliani was pushing for, which is, you know, the extradition of Fethullah Gulen back to Turkey. So why are all these people around the president doing the bidding of these authoritarian governments who seem to be getting what they want? Turkey got what they wanted. The quid was there. The pro is there. The quo is there. Syria is in the hands of Bashar al-Assad, and there are Russians in our barracks. So
I just want to check this on policy. So you've opposed Bashar al-Assad in Syria, and you opposed Obama letting Russia into to police Syria and the chemical weapons. This is a longstanding policy commitment of yours?
I'm just saying that there seem to be people close to the president who are pushing for things that Turkey and that Ukrainian and Russian oligarchs want. And some of these things are happening, and we need to understand why.
But you've always been a hawk on Syria.
I'm saying that why are these things happening, and why are the people connected to the president seeming to consistently do the same bidding for the same actors?
That's not an answer to the question.
I mean, have I always been a hawk on Syria? I don't know. But have I always wondered why there are criminals who keep getting into the White House who seem to be working for oligarchs and, you know, the Turkish government, which are not the nicest people on the face of the planet? Yeah, I wonder that too.
Let's take a break, actually. We can come back and talk more about Syria. And I'll be back with Rich Lowry of National Review and Lynette Lopez of Business Insider to talk about that. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing from our left, right, and center, and we want to hear from you too. Tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the free KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of New York Magazine. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Lynette Lopez, columnist at Business Insider. So this week, the president has shifted course a little bit with regard to Syria. He now says he wants to send a few hundred troops into Syria to try to protect oil fields that are there. He's saying that we're never going to let those fall into the hands of ISIS. Rich, I've been confused by this announcement for a few reasons, but one is my understanding from our experience in Iraq, it's not clear to me that we can send a few hundred guys and control the oil fields. That's a much more sort of resource-intensive operation than just trying to, you know, prevent the rise of ISIS bases and that sort of thing. What's the basis for this move by the president? Is there a coherent strategy here? Can it actually work?
I mean, it's all been post hoc after the decision that caused all this is the pulling back to make the way for the incursion by the Turks. And after that, you're just trying to mitigate bad results. And I'm not a military expert. I've seen people saying this is a tougher operation, kind of hold this territory and presumably, you know, to keep nasty actors from getting their hands on these resources. But it's as we discussed last week, it's just bad all around, and it's great for Russia. And Russia is solidifying its position in the Middle East in a way it hasn't since the 1970s when Kissinger and Nixon maneuvered Russia out of the Middle East.
Yeah, Lynette, I mean, this feels like one of those things where, you know, the president said for years, take the oil, take the oil. It's one of those things that becomes a mantra, and then he goes ahead and is like, okay, now make that policy do it. It's kind of like the wall.
It sounds like Yakety Sax is playing again. I don't think there is a coherent strategy. I think that the president is facing pressure from people within his own party, and he's being asked to do things, but that are kind of like putting a Band-Aid on a bullet wound.
Rich, as we've had this so-called ceasefire and where they're basically giving the Kurds their opportunity to withdraw from the land that Turkey wants, it seems like the level of anger at Turkey among Republicans in Washington fell precipitously with that announcement, even though the Turks are basically getting what they wanted and what we've been telling them for years that they were not allowed to have. Why would we relax sanctions on Turkey so quickly? And what do you make of what I've been actually a little bit surprised by the lack of resolve on Capitol Hill on the idea that, no, we do need to sanction Turkey over this?
Yeah, for whatever reason, this kind of bleached some of the opposition out of Republicans, just the sheer fact of the ceasefire. I don't know whether it's, you know, not having bad pictures or bad news reports of ethnic cleansing and atrocities. But I'm just not sure. You know, the Turkey thing is tricky because I'm not sure how much would be accomplished by sanctioning them at this point, because they're not leaving. And the thing to do would have been to threaten the sanctions before they went in. Now this is a fact on the ground. And Turkey, although, you know, they're terrible, they're an atrocious NATO ally. Erdogan is a thug. Compared to Russia, Assad, Syria, and Iran, Turkey is the best player, unfortunately,
Turkey is a better player than Iran, but it seems like these actors are talking to each other. You know, the Halk Bank scandal is related to Iran and also to the Erdogan administration. I don't necessarily think that it is. I don't think it's necessarily useful to separate everyone's in the region, all their goals, because it seems like their goals are aligned at this moment. Bashar al-Assad's goals are aligned with Erdogan's goals. Russia and Iran, they seem to want the same thing, which is getting the U.S. out of the region.
Don't we need to separate them because, in general, we're making choices between bad choices in this region? I mean, it's sort of, you know, we saw this with the intervention in 2013, right? Where it was like, well, there are all these problems with these, you know, these Syrian resistance forces that we might align with. And it's a matter of, you know, they're not as bad as Assad. It feels like, you know, in a lot of these places, we're going to have to make peace with the idea that we're going to be dealing with imperfect partners. And I realize that Turkey is not really a partner here anymore. But I don't think that we can necessarily expect to be, you know, thrilled with whoever's going to be in control of all the land here.
Yeah, that's probably true. But I think that there's a reason why we're getting closer and closer, and why Ron Wyden announced an investigation into the Erdogan administration's ties to Iran through the Halk Bank scandal. I think that we're going to know more about what these actors are talking about, doing together, and what their aims are. And I think we're going to be a little bit more realistic about it.
To the point about Halkbank, isn't it a little bit weird how, you know, we seem to be quite passive about the things the Turks have done that have undermined our sanctions against Iran, Rich?
Yeah, I don't have a good explanation for that. The Turks is just a hellish problem. You have someone inside the NATO tent who increasingly is acts like an adversary. So that's not a sustainable position over the long term, but it's also something that I think any administration would want to, you know, regardless of anything else is going on, kind of paper over because it's such a difficult problem to deal with.
Lynette, what have you been watching with WeWork this week?
If you didn't read Matt Levine at Bloomberg's column about Adam Neumann stepping away with a beautiful golden parachute from the WeWork disaster as it was sort of being taken over by SoftBank this week, I recommend that you do read it. It is very funny. As for WeWork, well, it seems that Adam Neumann, despite flying the company into a mountain, will walk away with over $1 billion. And that is upsetting to people, regular people, and even people on Wall Street who were about to try to sell us that company for $50 billion when it's now hovering around, what, $6 billion?
More than 50. They said 65 and 80 were the things that banks said it could be worth. Rich, I thought it was interesting. Senator Tom Cotton from Arkansas was tweeting about this. He's angry at Adam Neumann like everybody else is, and says, you know, he shouldn't be investigated, he should be sued. It strikes me, you know, is there anything Washington should be thinking about doing with these companies? Because I look at it, and Adam Neumann didn't own a majority of the company, but they had to pay him all this money to go away because he had this weird, well, it's not that weird anymore, this increasingly common share structure where he got extra votes on his shares. And so without owning the whole company, he was able to control the whole company. And that's why they had to pay him off to go away and stop leaving cereal boxes full of marijuana on private jets and doing all these other things that were against the interest of the shareholders. I mean, is there any reason for the government to allow that sort of ownership structure?
I don't know. I would say, you know, look, this looks terrible. A guy, nearly destroys this company and walks away with a lot of money. But it's a success to the extent the IPO crashed and burned because of market forces. And the people who were really done in here and lost a lot of money were the most sophisticated investors in the world who bought the business model, who bought this guy's rap. And they're the ones being hurt rather than, garden variety investors in Wall Street because the IPO failed. Because when people kicked the tires and market players kicked the tires more widely, they saw it made no sense. And he just unfortunately had a lot of leverage going out the door, so was able to get this golden parachute.
Yeah, I mean, Lynette, that's funny about people pointing to this as, you know, this is why people hate capitalism. Rich, I think, has a good point here about it's sort of in a walled garden. It's, you know, rich people losing money to other rich people in dumb ways. Maybe that's a good way or at least a better way for the system to work. If you're going to do these risky things, do it in the private market where, you know, public investors in their mutual funds don't get caught up in the mess.
Okay, one, yes. But also shout out to all the reporters who did great journalism on this and also exposed how crazy things were inside of WeWork. Two, that is correct. It is good that SoftBank is, you know, and all other rich people are the big bag holders here. But if you heard Jay Clayton, the head of the SEC, speak at Delivering Alpha a couple weeks ago, which is a CNBC conference, he was talking about figuring out how the SEC could get mom and pop investors into private investments like this earlier. So the focus of the Trump administration's SEC is not on protecting mom and pop. It's on getting them into things like WeWork before they hit the public markets because companies are staying in the private markets for so much longer. And if you check out that interview, it's a little upsetting because you're like, wait a second, like, we're witnessing this massive explosion in the private market just as it's on the brink of becoming public, which at which point, you know, in your world, mom and pop would already be invested. And that's concerning.
I think we might be saved by the passing of that fad, which is to say people were looking at these hot companies and being like, I can't get into them. Why can't I get into them? I think as, you know, not everything's imploding as badly as WeWork, but as things go public and lose value, people are saying, oh, maybe it's good that I wasn't able to get in them. Speaking of the concerns of people who are relatively well off, I was interested this week, the Senate voted on a resolution to reject IRS rules to implement the cap on the deduction for state and local taxes. That cap is part of the 2017 tax law, which cut tax rates. But this limitation on how much property tax, how much state income tax you can deduct, eats up a lot of the tax cut for some affluent families in highly taxed states like New Jersey and California. Some people's taxes even went up because of this, although not as many as the popular mythology would have it. About 5% of tax filers are paying more under the new law than they would have paid under the old law. Maybe it's 6% if you exclude the effects of the corporate tax cut. Anyway, this vote was essentially about making whole some of those taxpayers who felt like they didn't get a good deal out of this, giving a tax cut mostly to relatively affluent people who pay a lot of property tax, that sort of thing. And Democrats mostly voted yes on this, while Republicans mostly voted no. And Lynette, what I find crazy about this is literally Democrats voting for a tax cut for the rich. It's not mostly a tax cut for the very rich, but it's for people who have a higher standard of living than your average American.
We are living in a topsy-turvy world, guys. But, this is a Democrats' chance to oppose the president and presidential policy one more time, and this is for their voters. This is California, this is New York, this is New Jersey, this is their people. Do I necessarily agree? I don't know. But this seems like a very political move and not necessarily a really well-thought-out policy, tax policy initiative.
Rich, on the flip side, the affluent suburbs of major cities used to be a heartland for the Republican Party. You would have thought this was a major concern for them. A lot of the voters they might have catered to by trying to protect the state and local deduction have abandoned the Republican Party already anyway.
Yeah, that's part of it. Although it is consistent with the broad approach the conservatives have had to tax reform for a long time, which is broadening the base and lowering the rates. This is a way to broaden the base, and it's not, for the most part, their own voters being gored, which is obviously an upside as well.
Lynette, one other argument you do see for why Democrats want to restore this tax deduction is it's not just about the families, the relatively affluent, mostly families who get the deduction. It's basically a subsidy for spending by state and local governments. The idea is basically, if you're a state and you're going to collect an income tax, part of that gets refunded by the federal government. And so that helps support public services. The idea is public services might be undersupplied. This creates a subsidy to give you more of them. Certainly, this is a reason that public employee unions like the SALT deduction. This is also part of why Republicans don't like it. But I guess that is the more principled argument besides, we think families making $250,000 a year in fancy New Jersey suburbs need a tax break.
Yeah, this is about a fundamental argument between how much money government should have, like how services should be provided. And Republicans want to see more states that look like Florida, and Democrats don't. And that's a very valid argument to have. It just seems, a little petty to have it for the rich people in New Jersey.
And Rich, there's sort of a flip side argument about this for Republicans. This has been one of the longtime Republican arguments for getting rid of this tax deduction, that they do want more states like Florida. They think it's a subsidy for high spending states. But the flip side is sometimes people talk about this as fiscal federalism, that basically the federal government should not get in the way of states financing themselves. So I think that there's two ways to argue that from either side if you're a conservative.
It just seems like a subsidy for high tax states, and why should they get a special deduction for their taxpayers? So it seems more like special treatment from the federal government rather than true federalism.
Now it's time for Tweets of the Week. Sometimes it only takes 140 characters or maybe 280 to distill the spirit of the week. Lynette Lopez, what's your Tweet of the Week?
My Tweet of the Week is from Hunter Walker over at Yahoo News. And it says, the Trump campaign is hosting a Halloween witch hunt party with Matt and Mercedes Schlapp, Diamond and Silk, and other special guests. Yahoo!
That's actually kind of amazing. Rich Lowry, what tweet struck you?
It's from a former McConnell aide named Josh Holmes, and he's tweeting about a report about Congressman Katie Hill being the first female lawmaker to face House ethics inquiry on a sex-related matter. And he just tweeted, trailblazer.
My Tweet of the Week comes from the conservative blogger Ala Pundit, and it's about the Republican complaints that the president is not being given due process in the process of being impeached. He says, imagine an American citizen being indicted behind closed doors with no rights to challenge the prosecution without even having their lawyer in the room even. This tweet drew a huge number of responses along the lines of, that's how a grand jury works, idiot, because nobody on Twitter understands sarcasm. I've been talking with Lynette Lopez of Business Insider and Rich Lowry of National Review. We will be back with Amy Sellico to talk about the Phase 1 China trade deal. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from all sides. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and our companion show, All the President's Lawyers, at kcrw.com/podcasts or from the KCRW app.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Lynette Lopez, columnist of Business Insider. In a chaotic month for the president, one area where tensions have ratcheted down is with China. Earlier this month, the president announced an agreement in principle on a so-called Phase 1 trade deal with China that doesn't resolve all or even most of our trade dispute, but that will allow him, hopefully, to delay the imposition of tariff increases that have been threatened for later this year. As the U.S. and China work out the details of this Phase 1, we have questions. What's going to be in the deal? Did we win anything? And what does it mean for the future of America's relationship with China? Amy Sellico joins us now to discuss that. Amy is principal at Albright Stonebridge Group. She worked on China trade policy at the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative and at the Commerce Department. Hi, Amy. Thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you.
So first of all, is there a deal? You had this announcement from the president, but then they're actually working on putting together the terms of the thing they've supposedly agreed to?
That's right. They are, quote unquote, papering the deal that the two sides agreed to when the Chinese delegation led by Vice Premier Liu He came to Washington earlier this month, and they're papering something in order to present to both the Chinese and U.S. president so they can sign a deal at APEC, on the sidelines of APEC next month, we hope.
Do you have expectations about what's going to be in this deal, how substantive it will be, and whether there are remaining sticking points that could cause it to fall apart?
Absolutely. We have been looking, you know, observers of the relationship have been watching to see how real can an interim deal be when there's so much that still needs to be dealt with in the relationship. That's why they're calling it a Phase 1 deal. On the one hand, because they've taken out the harder issues, the industrial policy issues, subsidies, forced technology transfer, these very, very contentious issues out of contention for this Phase 1 deal, there is a higher likelihood that we are going to see something by November. And that deal would include agricultural purchases, hopefully a suspension or at least a delay in ratcheting up tariffs on both sides. The Chinese side is saying we want tariffs lowered, even for this interim Phase 1 deal to be finalized. And that could be a sticking point that really precludes the deal from coming together.
So, Rich, for several administrations, we've had concerns about what China was doing in our trade relationship. And President Trump has made this a focus, but the president has sort of focused in different places than we have traditionally. He at least talks a lot about the trade balance and about agricultural purchases and that sort of thing. The administration has been working on some of those other issues that Amy mentioned, like with intellectual property and forced technology transfers. But it seems it's sort of sounding between the lines like the big commitment we're likely to get in this Phase 1 deal is an agreement to met more agricultural purchases, which it doesn't seem to me addresses any of the real big long-standing issues in the China relationship. So it's not clear to me that we're going to get out of this and see that Trump has actually achieved anything important in our relationship with China in his first term.
Correct. So there'll be an assurance on agricultural purchases, and Trump obviously wants the biggest kind of headline number that he can wave around as possible. It's politically important to show farmers that they've gotten something out of the sacrifices they've made during the course of this trade war. And there may be, you know, items on intellectual property, things that have already happened or things that are relatively minor that just won't make a big difference. So it'll basically be a paper over deal the way I would have expected a long time ago before it had all the twists and turns. And at times I thought, oh, nothing's going to happen. But this seems to be coming back to a paper over deal that makes sense as a placeholder for both sides. And then I think you'll see the administration focused on hitting China and impinging on, you know, trade and commercial relationships on national security grounds increasingly rather than trade.
Do you see anything valuable out of this, Lynette?
I think it sounds a lot like the deal we had last December when we had a cessation of hostilities. And that deal broke in May when they started talking about thornier issues and trying to sign a final deal. And those are the thornier issues that are going to be avoided in this Phase 1 deal. So when we get to Phase 2, you know, it's a whole other story. It's a whole other ballgame. Meanwhile, in the background, as Rich said, national security issues are where the rubber is hitting the road in Washington. You're having, President Trump say he's getting along really well and negotiations are going really well, and you're having Congress increasingly hostile towards China because of Xinjiang, because of Hong Kong, because of all these human rights violations. And you have Mike Pence giving a speech this week where he was kind of talking out of two sides of his mouth. You know, on the one hand, he was like, you know, we abhor Hong Kong. It's a horrible violation of democracy. But we know behind the scenes, you know, Trump kind of has stopped. He has agreed not to back Hong Kong publicly in order for this deal to get through. So it's hard for this administration to have the moral high ground in terms of human rights violations and democracy, because it seems like this deal is puttering along in a little bit of a loop, and Trump wants it so badly, it's starting to look a little pathetic.
Amy, to something that Lynette mentioned there, that the spat with the NBA over this tweet about Hong Kong has drawn a lot of public attention to the way that China pressures multinational firms to hew to their political line on matters from Hong Kong to Taiwan to Tibet, all these sorts of things. And a lot of people in the U.S. are really upset about this. It, you know, it feels like a violation of our principles of free speech. It also is, frankly, a little bit embarrassing. You have these big American companies, and somehow China has all of this power over them. What can we do about that? Is there a way to approach that either in trade negotiations or otherwise through politics if we're concerned about this Chinese corporate influence? Is there a way to push back on it?
I think it really is difficult because I agree the Chinese government is putting increasing restrictions on how China is characterized, not just within China by foreign companies or individuals, but outside China. And this is something that the U.S. government is grappling with. How can you stop China from pushing others to self-censor about China outside of its borders? You certainly heard Vice President Pence very strongly condemn some Americans for not having, quote unquote, American values as they're working to continue to do business in China. But of course, this is very tricky because American companies, they do have a set of values. They also see China as a very large market for them. And so you can't be black and white on this issue. Either you're going to only promote American ideals or you're going to do business in countries where the ideals aren't shared by the governments there. So this is very difficult for U.S. companies, and I anticipate it's going to get harder as consumers here in the United States say, hey, we want our companies to promote our values, whether it's in the United States or overseas. Let me just add, I really think Vice President Pence was unfair about the NBA because they did very forcefully push back against Chinese criticism of the Rockets general manager. And so I think the NBA really did try to adhere to its values and say, hey, China is a big market for us, but we are not going to be beholden to the Chinese government in order to continue to show our very popular sports games to Chinese citizens.
Rich, I remain surprised by the president's reluctance to take this issue on personally, because I think Amy's right that the NBA, weak though their responses seemed in certain ways, is actually better than almost any of the other corporate responses that we have seen. And so it feels like it would be totally in Trump's wheelhouse to complain, like when DreamWorks uses a map of China in a film that includes the nine-dash line saying that China has control over the South China Sea, or when companies like Marriott or ESPN and other companies bend to Chinese pressure to hold to the Chinese line. The president loves calling out companies for not doing right by America, saying, you know, don't move this factory, that sort of thing. It feels like an issue where he could actually genuinely lead and get a lot of and be viewed positively by people on both sides of the aisle for the position that he could take, telling those companies to be more pro-American. I find it really weird that he doesn't want to capitalize on it.
It is very weird. We talked about this a couple weeks ago. Again, the only explanation I have is he's desperate for the deal with China, so he doesn't want to stir the pot. In that regard, and he's not particularly high on human rights in Hong Kong himself, naturally. So he kind of lets this one pass that would be a natural for him. And I will say, you know, the NBA formally, it stuck up for the idea of free speech, but as a practical matter, you know, everyone backed off and said this was terrible, and some of the biggest stars of the league said the same thing. And I think that's more meaningful than their kind of formalistic defense of their right to free speech and to criticize China when everyone says, oh, let's not do that again.
I think it's important that the Rockets GM still has his job.
Yeah. But Lynette, I think it's also interesting that this is the first one that I think really drew notice by consumers. I mean, nobody cared when Marriott International was saying, you know, we respect the territorial integrity of China. It makes me wonder if there's something that happened with the NBA that could be done to connect this issue to get U.S. consumers to care about it, because that's what these companies care about. They, you know, China and to some extent consumers in China, it's difficult to separate the government from the consumer public, but it matters on both levels. They care about this stuff. People in the U.S. don't really seem to care, but maybe they could care.
I think that people in the U.S. were very upset with the NBA about this, and that it got people's dander up. In China, obviously, yes, the state, the media, and consumers are very connected. The state is able to marshal consumers against or for a company whenever it seems to want. Here, we don't have that, but I think that if we had the right voice in politics in Washington about this kind of moral high ground, it could be a different story. I think that if politicians were more willing to say, hey, you know, we as American consumers don't have to put up with this, it's a question of leadership. And I think the desire to see American values is there. But, you know, we could go on about that for days.
Amy, assuming that this phase one comes together and they successfully paper the agreement and there's some agreement about agricultural purposes and whatever else, what should we expect in terms of phase two? I mean, I assume that at least the conventional wisdom has been that a reason the president has been pushing for this deal now is that he doesn't want to go into his reelection and into this impeachment fight at sort of maximal trade war pressure with China. It's just another problem that he'd have to deal with. He would like this to cool down a little bit. So is he then going to do the phase two negotiations during the election year as he's gearing up for re-election, or will this basically be put on hold all the way until after next November's election?
Yes, realistically, it's going to be very difficult in 2020 for the president to continue with much more contentious negotiations with the Chinese. And if you're going to take a cynical view of this phased approach to a trade agreement, the easy things are being done in phase one. Why are they easy? The agricultural purchases, the suspension of tariffs, because they harm both economies. And so both the United States and China, as you just said, President Trump is going to be able to deliver a victory. He's going to say to farmers, okay, we have the green light for you to return to selling products to China as you did before the trade war started. And consumer products won't see increases in prices, we hope, if the tariff, the phase tariffs don't increase on December 15th. That's part of phase one. And so it's good for China, of course, because their economy is slowing. They don't want to see these increased tariffs, but it's good for the U.S. On the phase two issues, it's only good for the U.S., for China to back off of its industrial policymaking. And so I think realistically, it's going to be very difficult to get the Chinese to make any progress on these issues, particularly in an election year when the president is going to have a lot more things to deal with and the likelihood of victory on this is going to be lower.
Amy Sellico is principal at Albright Stonebridge Group. Amy, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks so much.
We've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
None of us can imagine what it's like to spend the entirety of our adult life scheming and planning and working to attain the highest elected office in the land, only to come up short in a crushing manner in a very public way. But people do deal with this amazingly well. Al Gore went into a different line of work and made climate change a cause of his. John McCain doubled down on being an independent-minded lion of the Senate. Hillary Clinton could take a page from both of them. She is constantly insinuating she's somehow done dirty and really won in 2016 and now is playing footsie with rumors that she might run again. She needs to take a deep breath, go and do something more productive and healthy with her life.
Lynette Lopez, what's your rant?
My rant is about Mark Zuckerberg's Facebook testimony this week. You know, we're seeing this out of Silicon Valley a lot, where companies are saying, you know, you should let us do it. have this new technology and develop this new technology, because if not, China is going to get ahead of us. And this is what Mark is arguing with his Libra thing. If you don't let me do Libra, then, well, China, they're already working on a Libra with Tencent. So you gotta let me do it. And then in the next breath, during his same testimony, he's like, we don't want to reflect the values of China with our technology. Their values are bad. And we have American values. Sir, which is it? Which is it? Do you want us to keep up with China's weird surveillance state authoritarianism technology through your weird Libra situation? Or should we uphold American values and give people a little bit of privacy?
The Libra, the fake currency Facebook is working on, I just find this so weird. Because, like, the thing is clearly never going to work.
No.
So I don't understand why they spend so much time talking about it.
I don't understand why Mark Zuckerberg is insisting on doing this when it's dragging him in front of Congress to answer questions he doesn't want to answer.
For my rant, Elizabeth Warren is working on a plan to pay for her health care plan. The Washington Post reports her advisors are working with her so she'll be able to have an answer to give when she's asked at every single debate how she is going to pay for her very expensive single-payer plan. But none of the options sound really great. The Post talks with one economist who says she could say she'll redirect funds from Medicare and the Veterans Administration to pay for her plan. Another proposes a huge gross receipts tax on businesses. A third says she could say more explicitly what she's implicitly saying now, which is to say that most people will come out ahead paying less in taxes than they and their employers currently pay now in premiums, even if they will have to pay some new taxes. But that's not a your taxes won't go up message. It's a your taxes will go up, but you'll be better off message. And she was trying to avoid saying that for a reason. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Lynette Lopez, and Amy Sellico. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Colin Cab Washington and PJ Shahamat are our production assistants. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.